Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Just noticed that we've already eaten into quite a bit of our time, so I hope that we can carry on in terms of the designated time. Just as a housekeeping rule, I believe at 11 o'clock there's going to be a silence and a pause for a two-minute silence in remembrance of those who have fallen in the war since the First World War, you know, and their sacrifice for freedom. So I would just ask you at 11 o'clock, I think a siren will go off in the whole building. We just get up and pay our respects for 2 minutes. The topic for this morning is the first panel, Growing Islamic Finance Capacity and Standards. And I'm going to leave it to our distinguished panel here to interpret this as much as, to their liking. So, as far as I understand the topic, Islamic finance capacity in terms of what's happening in the market, in terms of government policy, regulation, standard setting, and of course product innovation, financial inclusion. So you've got a license, is a huge, of course, financial intermediation as well. So, and standards, some really fantastic standards coming out from both Basel G20 and of course the IFSB. And I also think this can be extended to our office standards, the financial reporting ones, and of course accreditation and quality standards in education as well, which is why we are here this morning. So we've got a very short period of time, so I'm going to ask each panelist to make an opening statement, and then we'll have a discussion and interaction with the audience. But let me just introduce, and I'll start on my right, Daud Vikriya Abdullah, who's very well known to everybody, but just for those who don't know him, he's got over 41 years experience in the industry, well, not only in Islamic finance, but as in his previous manifestation as head of global Islamic finance at Deloitte, and I'm sure there were other previous ones. But he's currently the president and CEO of INCF, which is the Global University for Islamic Finance. INCF is the International Center for Education in Islamic Finance. It's based in Kuala Lumpur. And they're doing really wide-reaching and fantastic work in terms of taking the Islamic finance education proposition not only to the region there, but to a much wider world. And I'm sure Dawood will elaborate further on that. Other speaker is Lawrence Oliver. Once I've known Lawrence for a very long time, since his days at Kleinwood, Treasurer Kleinwood, yeah. And he is the deputy CEO of DDCAP, which is one of the foremost intermediation companies in the Islamic finance space. He works together with his, I was going to say other half, but his Stella Cox, of course. So once again, huge experience in this particular field. And we have Umar Sheikh, formerly from Ernst & Young, chartered accountant, and is now a board member of the UK Islamic Finance Council. And I know you are very active in Scotland as well, with the Scottish government. So I'll leave it up to you also to add further. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Dawood to say a few words, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay, thanks very much, Mushtaq. Assalamu alaikum. Good morning, everyone. A few words is difficult because it's a very, very broad topic, and I kind of wish everybody who was in this room actually heard me speak last night. I was able to give a presentation with a wonderful group of students at King's College, and it was they allowed me about 2 hours to talk about this topic, and it was the past, present, and future of Islamic finance. So I'll try and condense this into about 2.5 minutes if I can. It's a huge topic, and the best way I can respond to this is by answering a question that I posed myself about 13 years ago, when I was asked what are the major things that we need to be thinking about in Islamic finance. And I answered education, perception, and liquidity, and I don't think I differ from that answer. However, the way I reach that now is considerably different. And education, I think, is at the heart of everything. And 13 years ago, I was at Deloitte. INCF hadn't even been born yet, let alone thought about. And we were in a situation where Islamic finance was looking to grow fairly rapidly, but where was the human capital coming from? And so education was a very vital thing. And I remember, you know, 10 years ago when I was first CEO of an Islamic bank, and Sultan will identify with this, you know, the challenge was, where are the people coming from? And I was in Malaysia, which was actually the heartland of Islamic finance. And I recall very well a conversation I had with now my boss, Governor Zetti, where the expectations were that Malaysia had far more people qualified in Islamic finance than there actually were. And I said, I think the number you presented me, and I think she mentioned something like 700 qualified people, I said it was probably closer to 70. And I said, would you like me to name them all? And she said, yes. And I gave a list. And I named all 70 people who were capable. And that was 10 years ago, and INSEAF was born as a postgraduate university, really to start tackling, from the Malaysians' perspective initially, a global shortage of capability. Roll forward 10 years, and I never believed 10 years ago I'd be running INSEAF, but you know, fate plays strange tricks on you. You know, INSEAF has produced at master's and PhD level close to 1,100 graduates. This last convocation, 248 graduates at master's and PhD level from 67 countries. It's not as wide and diverse, Siraj, as UEL. I think Dusty was mentioning 140 countries. We have students from over 80 countries, but these students are making an impact. They're making an impact in terms of research. One of our students is helping set up the first Islamic banking window in Russia. One of our Somali students, who was in our first batch, went back to Somalia and set up an incubation center for us. The highest number of graduates after Malaysians at our recent convocation was from Somalia.
Oh, okay. At 11 a.m. We would like you to join us in observing a period of 2 minutes silence to mark Remembrance Day in honor of those men and women who died protecting their country. Thank you.
I thought I'd be paused there. I was worried that I'd spoken for 20 minutes already, and I've probably got a minute or two. So education, perception, and liquidity were absolutely vital. You know, but what is going on? Education clearly does change perception. And I identify a lot of things that our keynote speaker, Baron Swasi, was discussing. I certainly think that GIFIG, and I sit on the Global Islamic Finance Investment Group, and it was a great honor to be there. I'd still like to be very active on it, and I think it's something that I would like to see reactivated. I think, you know, the areas for growth for us in Islamic finance are getting the messages across to a different audience, but also using different people there. And I very much identify with what Iqbal Azaria was saying, that, you know, changing opinions through evidence and getting evidence coming from sources which you wouldn't normally suspect, you know, the work that Adair Turner is doing, Stephen Keane, John Kay, gives a certain sense of credibility to what Islamic finance is about in terms of risk sharing, but looking at it from the point of view of the elimination of debt and the promotion of equity as a risk sharing. The work that's been done and some of our own research at INSEAF on anti-fragility and the role of Islamic finance in anti-fragility. I'm not a smart quant jock, and I don't understand this stuff in a huge amount of detail. But it strikes me that trying to predict the next crisis in terms of value at risk calculations, which Basel III is doing, is an exercise in futility, because it's rather like trying to figure out where Cristiano Ronaldo is going to kick the ball and precisely where, predicting where in the goal that he's going to score the goal. Whereas in the world of Islamic finance and risk sharing and anti-fragility, I much rather train and get the fittest and most agile and capable goalkeeper to actually save the shot. So I'm looking at, you know, approaching the problem for a different angle. I think there are areas in terms of growth here where we should be looking at, you know, new methodologies, you know, innovative stances in areas around fintech, about impact investing. I was on a panel last week in KL where a number of you were for the World Islamic Economic Forum, an absolutely fascinating panel where a young man, 28 years old, a graduate of Harvard but from Uganda, his name was Sangul Dali, who's doing a massive amount of impact investing in Africa, largely around mobile banking and telephony. He staggered me by saying there are a billion mobile phone users in Africa. And you look at countries like Kenya using M-Pesa, you look at the way in which fintech could be used to actually have impacts on the pharma industry, on healthcare and on education. It's a completely new dimension. And Islamic finance, I feel, needs to be moving rather more quickly into that space than it has. So this area of creative disruption is a very important area. I've mentioned risk sharing. The title of this conference is about East and West, and I think it's about collaboration. One thing that we do try to do, and I think Malaysia has done it very well, and you will hear other speakers from Malaysia today, talk about this, is the area of collaboration. You know, the collaboration. I'm fortunate that I know most of the people in this room, but I haven't lived in this country since 1988, you know, but I do come back regularly. And the collaboration through research collaborations, through collaborations, you know, with industry, the work that we do, you know, similar people show up for similar things and give their times very regularly. And I'm nodding my head at Sultan, and I probably nod my head at Stella, who's at the back. You know, we sit on something called the Responsible Finance Institute, which may be changing its name, but the idea there is about ethics and finance, and it grew. We had our first meeting in Edinburgh, Omar, you'll remember, just before the Global Ethical Finance Forum. This whole area is one where we actually have to produce the demonstration effect. Our research needs to provide that demonstration effect, and we should be talking to an audience in a way that does not say, well, the concept is it's about risk sharing, and we do this, and we use the I word, and people would immediately get into the sort of religious side of things. We can demonstrate through our research that this is better, and we can prove that empirically, mathematically, it's a better return on investment, it's a lower cost of funds, it shifts the risks profile in a different area, and fundamentally it's better for all humanity. But we've got to actually stand up and demonstrate that, and we've got to also put it away across in a way where we don't alienate. I think Saida used the Daily Mail thing. I'm a little less in contact with Daily Mail, but I've spoken three times in the US this year, and I failed miserably in not getting booed off the stage. And the reason why I didn't get booed off the stage was I didn't start my presentation by going Allahu Akbar. I talked about similarities at one conference between Mutual Insurance and Takaful, and built up a profile where we were able to demonstrate that there were huge similarities between Mutual Insurance and Takaful. The similar analogy that was used for credit unions here. There's a mass of stuff where actually Islamic finance has contributed significantly to the growth of the finance industry, but we just lose sight of this stuff. And I'll close out by saying, you know, don't forget endowment funds. The first college at Oxford, Merton College, founded 1264, used the Islamic concept of wakaf as its endowment. And that is the basis of university funding everywhere in the world, but it's an Islamic concept. I'll rest there.
Okay, thank you, David. As usual, a lot of points that have been brought up there, but I think we'll have a chance to discuss them later on in some of the other panels as well. Just, I think, in terms of the Daily Mail, I think that's become passé now. Yeah, because since WIEF, I've seen some very positive headlines in the Mail on Sunday and Daily Mail about Islamic finance. Okay, I think they're starting to get a grip. I'd be more concerned about the Daily Star and the Daily Express. In this country, it's fantastic. You know, you can have a purveyor of soft porn also becoming, you know, the right-wing guardian of British values and morals. So, listen about that.
I knew there was a reason I left the country in 1988. I don't follow them online that much.
Okay, Lawrence, the floor is over to you.
Thank you, Mushtaq.
Financial intermediation, and how do you perceive it?
Thank you, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think I'd like to focus more on the whole issue of Islamic finance and growing the capacity of the industry. And my opening remarks would really focus from the perspective that I've been very privileged to be involved in this industry now for more than 20 years. So I've overseen what has been a remarkable speed of growth of the industry. But I think undoubtedly over those years, Islamic finance has always, if you want to find fault with it, has always suffered from the perspective that compared to its conventional equivalent of products, there have been, over the years, comments as to inefficiencies in the way in which the transactions are structured, the processes that are conducted, the need to have what is effectively a great deal of paperwork to support each and every transaction that's arranged in a Sharia-compliant way. And I think what I, where I want to direct my opening remarks is more from the perspective of what we've seen more recently, which has been moves to improve the efficiency of the entire system. Very positive moves. And in the last few years, probably the last 5 or 6 years, we've been encouraged very much by our institutional and banking clients to focus on ways in which systems, IT systems, etc., can enable Islamic finance to move forward so it can compete directly with its conventional market equivalent of products in a way in which, for example, the need for paperwork can be eliminated so that effectively transactions are now capable of being arranged in a fully electronic manner whilst at the same time ensuring Sharia adherence. This has been a big focus. Institutions are very keen to try and identify ways in which full straight-through processing of these transactions can be achieved. We at DDCAP have spent a number of years now and a great deal of time and indeed money in investing in a product that we can offer now to our clients that can provide 24/7 capability of transactional arranging with full documentary support provided immediately to clients, whilst at the same time, and very importantly, ensuring at all times full Sharia adherence in terms of the timing of the structure of the confirmation exchange, time stamping on all of the confirmations to ensure that Sharia boards, and we have our own, are happy that we're following exactly the preset requirements as documented with each customer. So I think this is just an example of a way in which, a positive example of a way in which the Islamic finance industry now is moving forward. IT is a key component of that now. The ability to be able to provide instant responses to client requests is a prerequisite that the banks expect to have delivered to them. And for intermediaries such as ourselves, that is something we have been asked to and are delivering.
Okay, thanks, Lawrence. Once again, I agree with you that IT is a major component of not only Islamic finance, but the whole financial revolution. And I know Islamic banks, say, for instance, in Kenya, First Community and the Gulf African Bank, they are making full use of, especially the mobile phone. Having said that, also there's a challenge also in terms of adopting electronics and IT and all this in terms of cost of finance. Because in some markets, despite the advantages of IT, the cost of finance is still very high, especially to the ordinary person. If you take a market like South Africa, a lot of customers there complain bitterly because South Africa, I don't know whether you realize, it's got probably the highest bank charges in the world. They even charge you for putting your own cash into your account. So there is, the two sides to it in that sense. I'm speaking up for the ordinary consumer here as well. Anyway, I'll move on to, there are a few other points which I'd like to take on further, but I'll move on to Umar, and let's have your opening statement in terms of the topic.
Sure, okay. Thank you, Mr. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'd just like to make three points, conscious of time, so I'll keep it brief. I think what we need to remember in this whole debate of Islamic finance and capacity and standards specifically is the nature of Islamic finance. And many people so often forget this. This is, the industry is a horizontal niche, right? It's a horizontal niche. What does that mean? It means when you're working in risk management, when you're working in private equity, when you're working in insurance and banking, you need to understand how those work. And then you understand the nuances and the differences and the subtleties that relate to Islamic banking products or Islamic insurance products and so on. So that actually should answer or redefine your thinking towards training and capacity and standards, where you deal with the tweaks and the amendments and so on. That in itself brings a question as well about the, the aspirational dissatisfaction in Islamic finance, where it being too much of an imitation, sometimes a cheap imitation as well for that matter. But I think the importance of capacity and standards, of course, that's obvious. We do a lot of work at the Islamic Finance Council in two key areas, which has impacted this directly. One is we do a lot of government policy advisory across Africa and different European countries, and we've always said to regulators, you cannot regulate something which you do not understand. So there's a core requirement to build executives, regulators, bankers, and other finance professionals who have that understanding of Islamic finance, and that has to build on top of their understanding of conventional finance. And that's where institutions like NCF have done and other academic institutions have done a great job in providing those courses, and I think more needs to be done for that. The other area of work that we spend a lot of time in, which is a great example of where the UK's contributed globally, is supporting and empowering Sharia scholars and building standards and capacity within that space. We pioneered here in London by initiating, together with CISI and us at the Islamic Finance Council, a global training program to train Sharia scholars on conventional finance. As we say in the London Underground, mind the gap. There was an issue here of capacity, there was an issue of understanding. And that program went on to inspire regulatory changes at Bank Negara, who took the lead, who made that a requirement to have CPD-style training for their Sharia scholars. So I think that's one thing I wanted to mention. The final two points, one is around, it's been talked about, ethical finance, and this is probably targeted more towards some of the younger students and others in this space. Islamic finance, again, if you look at it from a fiqhi perspective, everything is halal except that which is specifically haram, so it comes under the area of mu'amalat. I think the issues of Islamic finance aren't particular to Islam, as we've talked about. It's actually, Sheikh Saleh Khan will mention, it's Abrahamic finance, which is a better term to explain this. We had a lovely round table with the Archbishop of Canterbury, actually. We're the only Islamic finance organization who's had that conversation with him in the House of Lords, to talk, along with Rabbi Naftali, to talk about the shared values. And I think if you look at the broader market, broader society, people from different faiths, indeed no faith, and all different backgrounds, are increasingly asking to see a more systemically stable and a more fairer form of banking and finance. And
ladies,
that's not something.
That's 11 o'clock. In 15 minutes' time, at 11 a.m., we would like you to join us in observing a period of 2 minutes' silence.
15 seconds or minutes, he said.
In honor of those men and women who died protecting their country. Thank you.
I should continue until we interrupt it.
Ladies and
gentlemen, okay.
In 15 minutes' time, at 11 a.m.,
it's 11, isn't it?
We would like you to join us in observing a period of 2 minutes' silence to mark Remembrance Day in honor of those men and women who died protecting their country. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen,
they'll probably go off now.
It is approaching 11 o'clock, and we would now like you to join us.
Shall we start?
Yes. Okay.
Thank you, everybody, for that. It's always good to remember those who have fought for freedom everywhere. I think we can continue now, Omar.
Sure. Particularly with the large contribution from the British India as well, the largest ever voluntary army in history that came to protect Britain and Europe and its interests. There were over 50,000 Muslims dying in that. So that itself is a great contribution. If anyone ever says Muslims don't give their life for this country, then I think they have a short reading of history. Back to Islamic finance. So I would just say, I think there's a lot of interesting kind of opportunity within looking at the broader shared values in the ethical finance universe. If you look at impact investing, if you look at some of the challenger banks like Triodos Banks, if you look at some of the new asset management techniques, a lot of these are very much looking at this space of like green bonds and carbon neutrality and stranded assets. All of these are core issues, pertinent issues, which are moving in society. And I think students and people who are studying Islamic finance, if they can broaden their perspective to look at that, I think it will also help them get into areas of employment and try and engage in a sector which has a broader shared values. I mean, we've been holding, again, we're the only Islamic finance body in the UK who's been holding a series of systematic structured roundtables focusing on ethical finance in Edinburgh over the last 5 years. Nobody else would do that. And I can say the level of synergies that are there, the shared values which are there, are phenomenal and absolutely worth looking at and exploring further. And just finally, with regards to a comment that was made about products, ultimately you can build and train as many people as you want. You can have armies lying there, but if there's no jobs, if there's nothing for them to deploy that talent against, guess what? It's a lot of pent-up fury and disappointment and so on. Yes, I've always encouraged people to go abroad to deeper markets like Bahrain, Malaysia, and so on. I've been saying that for over 10 years since I've been back from Bahrain. But I think you need to develop a stronger domestic retail Islamic finance market here. And I would say that also requires communities to come up with their own solutions as well. Relying on banks funded through the Middle East money, frankly, is only one strategy. I think if you want solutions locally, which, you know, I would encourage to be open-minded solutions to everyone in society. You can use technology now to come up with disruptive business models, but unless we build practical alternative options for people, a lot of this capacity is going to go to waste.
Okay, thank you, Omar. I'm just going to ask, start off with a couple of questions, and then I'm going to open it up to the you know, audience for discussion. I mean, Dawood, you mentioned the three you know, core issues which you talked about: education, perception, liquidity. I'm going to leave education aside in the sense that you know, we're going to discuss it further on in further panels as well. This question of perception, and it links into what Iqbal mentioned earlier. I mean, we've had this interfaith, multi-faith approaches about Abrahamic and all that, also talking to Sharia, but I still get the impression that the industry lacks confidence in terms of especially engaging with, if you like, not the academia, but the intellectual side in terms of presenting the case of Islamic banking theory and other theories in this sense. And I don't know why this is, and I can refer to just my own observations of the industry. A couple of years ago, for instance, at the World Capital Markets Forum in Malaysia, you had two probably of the most important economists in recent history, Paul Krugman, a Nobel laureate, and also Laura Tyson, the advisor to the U.S. president. And nobody, I mean, Krugman's basic contention was, oh, the problem is all to do because China is not consuming enough. There's a consumption problem. I want to know why the industry is not engaging in them, because these are the people who are the ideas people, if you like, and they influence their political masters. Why is that not? I mean, if you look at the Islamic finance sector, there's a huge gap, a huge deficit in terms of communicating with our political masters, if you like, in getting over the message. And I don't mean about, you know, what Murabaha is and all this. I'm talking about the real theoretical basis. Why this is good for an economy, why this is good for society, why this is good for inclusion, both social and financial inclusion. Why is this the case?
It's a great question, and I wish I had the rest of the day to answer it, but I'll try and answer it on the before I catapult out of the back of this chair. I'll try and answer it very, very succinctly. I think there is an issue of confidence to a certain extent, of taking the argument to, you know, to tougher audiences, but I think we're getting over that. Last week I was at a dinner in KL, the surrounds of the WIEF, and I was at a table with my boss, Governor Zeti, and His Royal Highness Sultan Nazrin from Perak, who is the, shall we say, the patron of Islamic finance in Malaysia, and as a Harvard graduate is actually reasonably smart on this. And he was asking the question, you know, where is the market where we actually need to get the message across? And in unison, Abbas Mirakor and I answered the United States, that we actually need to get that message across very clearly there. And I do see signs of change there. 3 weeks ago, I was invited to speak at the FMA, the Financial Management Association, 3,000 delegates from all across the US, academics, professionals, first time Islamic finance had been on the agenda. And what got them there, or what got them in terms of the presentation I made and three other people made, was the empirical evidence. It wasn't about the theory, it was about the theory plus we can demonstrate that this is working. This is what we would do in monetary policy, this is what we would do in terms of moving from debt to equity. We've got research which demonstrates this. So I agree with you that we actually do need to take the argument and convince some people, but we need to build our confidence and we need to seize these opportunities. And that reinforces the need of the first point, which you asked me to avoid because we're talking about it later, is we actually have to have the education to build the confidence and the research agendas which are funded by industry in order to address the issues which promote the argument further and get it disseminated to a broader base of capable people to actually stand up and make that assessment. I was explaining to students last night, I'm fortunate. I don't look like a Muslim, so I actually act as a little bit of surprise. I went to Kingston University yesterday to meet with Professor Stephen Keane, and I was in the lobby texting him, and he was texting me, and he said, "Where are you?" And I was dressed not in this suit, but a suit, and he was dressed in his cycling kit. And because my name's Daud Vickery Abdullah, he was looking for somebody completely different. And as my boss, Governor Sesi, says about me, I'm the stealth weapon. Because I don't look like one, with all due respect to everybody in this audience. And you get the chance to get messages across. But you need to have, you know, A, the confidence, and B, the opportunity, which goes beyond, you know, the 9-second soundbite. You actually need to develop the argument. And if you use up part of your 9 seconds in the US and other markets by going Allahu Akbar, you're challenged in that. You've got to get the messages across based on business, based on similarities, more similarities than differences, similar heritage. The work that Omar's been doing in terms of interfaith is you know, there are more similarities than differences.
Sure.
And you know, people overlook this. So there's it's a confidence issue and it's building the base.
I can assure you in my interaction with policymakers, quite a few other stealth makers, you know.
Yes, there are. I'm not.
And believe me, some of them, when you talk to them about Islamic finance, the first word comes out, oh, we don't want that religious stuff, you know.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
their perception. Yeah. The utter ignorance about the proposition is sometimes breathtaking in that respect. Lawrence, in terms of the fintech revolution and that, are you finding that the market is taking this on in a serious way, or is it a question of, you know, educating your clients, your customers, or that, I mean, and are they aware of the potential, both in terms of delivery, you know, the speed and the progress and the cost of delivery and all that, and the ability to, if you like, promote in terms of what I call business inclusion rather than just financial inclusion?
It's an interesting question. Our principal shareholder, our chairman, is Michael Spencer of ICAP PLC. And one of the early observations he made to us when we were very first asked to start looking at the evolution of electronic product offering was, you will find you'll be asked initially for these products by everybody, but the take-up will be very slow. And that was a very wise observation he made. because that's exactly what we found in the early stages. We were asked to rapidly produce an initial electronic product offering, which we did, and a number of the clients who had initially asked for that, when it was actually available, there was then reticence as to whether to use it or not. Yeah. What we're now seeing, though, in the last couple of years has been a rapid take up of that product. I think what people are seeing is because of the efficiencies it provides, for example, in Dowd's home base of Kuala Lumpur, for example, where we face an 8-hour time zone difference at the current time, this provides 24/7 capability. So the clients like the fact that the facilitation services that we offer are available to them in their own time zone, without having to wait for our London office to open to enable to facilitate transactions. There is also reticence from time to time that we see, or fairly regularly, from institutions from an IT perspective about the headaches that they perceive of trying to link systems one to another. Our system doesn't actually require that. It's just a web-based system, but it can link if the customers require it to their own system. So I think to answer your question, customers are increasingly accepting and taking what is offered to them, but it's been a slow take on. But as they're seeing the efficiencies that it provides, the speed of response, the instant responses that they receive, I think clients are realising this is the way forward, this is a way to grow the capacity of the industry.
Yes, the first to say is ICAP is one of the probably the world's largest
inter-dealer,
online.
Okay.
I mean, having said that, we've had some smaller, much smaller attempts at this, and I remember Islam IQ and Al Hilal and even the Bursa Souq Al Sila. It's a work in progress because it's a much greater, I mean, the former two are no longer in existence, but especially some of the commodity, Dubai has got a commodity trading platform as well, but these are much slower in terms of
I think one of the big issues they face is capacity and availability of asset flow, which is something we try to supplement for them.
But I consider that as a positive element because there's still room for improvement.
Exactly.
Room for, So, Umar, just before I come to the audience, very briefly, in terms of your engagement with the Sharia scholars and also in terms of the multi-faith, what has been the response? What has been the feedback in terms? Are you getting your message through? Are they interested? Where do you take it to from there?
I mean, the work that we've done with the Sharia scholars, our approach has been, it's very easy in the industry to point fingers and people come out with all kinds of comments like scholars for dollars and X, Y, Z, right? But our approach has been very different. It's actually to work with the scholars and to empower them. They're doing a fantastic job and they're asked to, the burden that's been put on them is quite considerable. If you go back to my old firm at EY, if you want an opinion or you go to a legal firm, you want an opinion on banking, you go to one partner. You want an opinion on insurance, you go to another partner. On private equity, it's different, so on. Here you got one scholar who's being asked every question from every angle. So our approach has been actually, what can we do to empower the scholars and to work with them? In that sense, we created the capacity building program, which ISRA in Malaysia was our first international partner. It was launched by the UK government. It's been rolled out with the Central Bank of Nigeria, with Governor Miraj in Bahrain. So some of that approach, for example, the professional institutes that we have in Britain, some of the workings around that has inspired and kind of worked into what's going on globally there. In terms of the interfaith and the different strands of ethical finance, from our round tables, we've gained fantastic insights. And one of the big announcements that was made just 3 weeks ago is the establishment of an ethical finance hub in Edinburgh that will be to bring together the various strands in ethical finance to see where we can collaborate more. Credit unions was mentioned in the morning. We did a piece of work with the largest credit union in the country to see how they can create an Islamic product. They have fundamental issues, right? And I think that goes back to some of the systemic implications, if I can just touch on Dowd's point. I think Islamic finance, the strategy that we took, as I understand from Barbai and others in the late 70s, to go down the imitation role of banking, set us a stall, right? Set us a kind of parameters. And I think that's been one of the issues as to why we're now struggling today in terms of addressing customer aspirational dissatisfaction, but also presenting a genuine alternative model. Now, we know from the banking crisis there's something to be said about bringing back Glass-Steagall. There's something to be said about economists who said everything. There was an efficient allocation of resources in the market. There's nothing wrong here, right? You know, as Alan Greenspan most famously said himself, right? So I think going back to the economists and saying, which economists do we have? Well, we have a Bass-Mercourt, we have others. But we have some systemic principles which I think need to be reconsidered, like the role of banking, the role of monetary reform. And I think people like Bass-Mercourt have made some very good comments on that. And actually, if we can present an alternative model to the world, I think you might have more of a useful engagement.
Yeah, I consider Alan Greenspan the Henry Kissinger of international finance, and I won't tell you what I mean by that. Anyway, that's something. Let's have some questions from the world. Iqbal, do you want to? Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. I just want to take up from where Umar left off that. Do you think the Islamic finance industry has become too comfortable with the narrow Sharia compliance to even envisage disruptive change in a new direction? And probably that's why we're not getting take-up from the Islamic finance industry. We're getting take-up from other economists, people outside to this agenda.
I think that's a very pertinent question. And, you know, Iqbal is my other half. We like to ask the provocative question.
I mean, I have a point of view on this, and actually I've discussed it with Iqbal and I think several people in the room. Interestingly, in Malaysia, as an extension of what Umar was discussing, you know, the inclusion of the Sharia scholars and the level of discussion, Malaysia has been quite innovative in this area. The Sharia scholars now have to attend compulsory continuing professional development. And if they don't, they'll be disqualified from sitting on Sharia boards. So they actually have to do this. And it's not just about their learning more of the business issues, which are there in the program there. It's also encouragement, especially under the Islamic Financial Services Act of 2013, for the Sharia scholars to actually move away from or move into fresh territory. And by that, I mean they no longer are being encouraged just to produce a fatwa or a decision on whether this product works or is Sharia compliant or not. They're actually being encouraged to look at the overall outcome of the business that is going on. In other words, the objectives of Maqasid al-Sharia. Now, this is very challenging. Why? Well, they do understand the objectives of Maqasid al-Sharia. But if you're looking at it in the context of, you know, ethical finance, and you've got a very legitimate ijara construct, but the outcome of that ijara construct is something that is used to go away and destroy the rainforest. And I use an example of a bulldozer which has been leased and it goes into Sarawak and demolishes 2,000 hectares of rainforest every day. That's not Sharia compliant. But how competent are they to actually gauge, you know, the carbon emissions and what the money is being used for? But it's moving the Sharia scholars more into this space and giving them the support to actually do the job more robustly in terms of measuring the outcomes of the impact of Maqasid al-Sharia. Yeah. And I think this is a very, very important area. That will change the dimension of how we work this. And Malaysia is once again the first mover in encouraging and educating the Sharia scholars to head in that direction.
Though sometimes even the regulators can get carried away by their own exuberance. I mean, the Islamic Finance Services Act, you know, some of the provisions are what I would consider a bit outrageous, in the sense that making board members responsible for Sharia compliance in an institution and deliver. I mean, the local banks are, taking that up with the ZETI and all that, because you can't expect an ordinary board member to be proficient in Islamic finance in the Sharia aspects and be responsible for that delivery.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have a point, and I agree with that. But
I know.
But I think a stake has been put in the ground. The intention is to move it away from, and I think what Omar was describing very, very well, is that, that we've got, you know, legitimate Sharia products, but they're really a conventional product in the Sharia wrapper, I'll put it, you know, bluntly. They're Sharia compliant, but they're based on what the market would bear and tolerate, and we've kind of made a rod for our own backs. But what's interesting, and I would argue here, we wouldn't have Islamic finance today had we not gone down that route. Sure. So let's not argue about we should have, you know, benefit of hindsight's a wonderful thing. Now we have an opportunity, we're at the tipping point where we put a stake in the ground and we try and aim for it and correct that.
Okay, just one more question and I'll wrap up. One more, okay. Because, one more question, okay. Can you be brief, please, because of time?
Thank you. To Lawrence, thanks for your insight. I just want to find out if, in your experience, you think that IT security might be a factor in the uptake of new products in terms of...
It's a good question. It's something that we're asked to focus on by all institutions. The need to prove and have tested the systems that we're offering is something that clients ask us for. We're frequently asked to perform penetration tests and produce evidence to show that independent parties have tried to attack the system to ensure that the integrity of the information contained therein remains therein and cannot be sourced from outside sources. The levels of security we've been asked to go to in constructing these systems. A simple example would be, initially at in our firm, we had one operating firewall to protect the system. We now have three. And this has all been driven by client requirement, saying to us that they were happy with what we had, but they would prefer it if we increased and put additional security measures in place. So I think to answer your question, security is in the utmost of clients' minds with any new product innovation. They have to ensure that they're comfortable, that what they're being offered provides them, for them, the security that they need of this, to ensure that the information that's being exchanged is remaining in a secure environment. And it's something we've had to focus very, very much on.
Yes, I know this question of cybersecurity and finance is now a major evolving issue. And I was at a conference in Doha a couple of weeks ago, and there's some interesting developments. But I think this is a very, very, very real issue. Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank our panelists, Daoud Vickery, Lawrence Oliver, and Omar Sheikh, for their contributions. And at the end of the day, I will sum up some of the points, so I'll leave that to later. And let's be back about 10, 15 minutes' time for the next panel session. I mean, as I said, we started late, so we'll try to catch up as we go along. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.